Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Health Riverside Methodist Hospital is taking students out of the classroom and putting them into virtual reality to learn about household hazards that could threaten their patients. Dr. Lori Hamama is the program director for the Family Medicine Residency at Ohio Health Riverside Methodist Hospital. She helped develop the simulation and use virtual reality in her curriculum. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How did you get into VR as an educational tool?
So we've been using simulation of many types for a long time in medical education curriculum, just to teach those really high-risk situations that don't happen very often, to give residents and medical students some comfort before they get into the situation, such as CPR or a really complicated procedure. So the first time they're doing it isn't on a patient. But our director of simulation, Dr. Brad Gable, connected us with Ohio University to think about a new novel type of simulation with virtual reality. So we really wanted to think about a unique way to use this to train our residents to make sure they all had a similar experience and similar, were meeting similar goals for their education.
So simulation is one thing. Virtual reality is different, right?
Mm-hmm. A little bit, yeah. So it's a simulated environment. There's lots of different types of virtual reality and how you can apply it. But simulation is kind of the broad term that virtual reality falls under.
Okay. And tell us about how virtual reality works in this lesson.
So this particular lesson that we did with the our residents and our medical students was to train them on how to, counsel patients and recognize household hazards that could injure young children, especially when they have new babies in the home and we're doing counseling on baby-proofing the house. So this particular simulation, when the residents put on the VR headset, they are immersed in the home of a new family, and they can either walk around the house from an adult viewpoint or a child's viewpoint on the floor crawling around. And as they are moving throughout the house, they can identify different hazards that they see. And then if they're able to correctly identify them by looking at it, then there's actually information that pops up to talk to the resident or the learner about what they're looking at and why it's a problem.
And why do you think this is a better approach than a lecture?
So most of us, especially adult learners, tend to do better with an experience rather than just hearing. And the visual component of it is also really, it helps us retain the knowledge that we're receiving a lot better. So any experiential learning works a lot better than a lecture. And our newer generations of learners, particularly Gen Z, this is how they've learned all along. So this is part of a way to meet our new learners where they are.
And especially, so you start with this, why this experience as opposed to other kinds of issues that are, that they would need to consult patients on?
Yeah, so what we really wanted to do, this is the second time that we've used virtual reality. Our first simulation was actually a home visit for a geriatric patient looking at many similar types of hazards that are different for, older individuals. But, it's really just to talk about these things doesn't really solidify the information when you're just talking or lecturing. And so we also can't get every person into a patient's home to do a home visit that's consistent, so that we wanted everyone to have the exact same experience. So we made sure that we were teaching all the objectives that we needed to teach in a really systematic and unified manner.
I see a little bit of a theme here, and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but we've got interns, usually youngish, learning about things they probably don't have a lot of experience with, that is childproofing a home and understanding what an older person experiences.
Absolutely. And so, I remember myself, I had my first child, my third year of residency, and there were so many things that I learned as a parent. And I said, wow, I have not been talking to my patients about this.
Huh.
So, because until you've experienced, and maybe I read about it in a lecture, but, or, heard about it, but until you experience it, it doesn't stick the same way. So we wanted to give people these experiences to really prevent, you know, some really disastrous outcomes if they could counsel their patients about them.
So childproofing a home, dealing with older patients in their home, what are some other avenues this might take?
Yeah, so that's what we've really been thinking about is, you know, kind of the next steps. What could it be? So, you know, there are different applications that look at, right now we have a standardized patient sitting next to you, and so you can have a conversation with them. There are actual virtual reality simulations where the patients, then you can see the patient and they can respond to you. So we could really think, you know, the sky's the limit on, you know, difficult patient conversations, you know, really having a very interactive type of situation. So I think there's a lot of applications where we can go next.
Like, in other words, use it for role playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when somebody is using this virtual reality lesson on childproofing a home, what do they see when they're crawling around?
Yeah, so in this particular simulation that we did, this virtual reality, they were looking for those household hazards. So, and things that you wouldn't normally, that just seem everyday to you. So for instance, dog food on the floor. That's where most people feed their dogs. But when the dog hasn't finished their food and it's left out, that's a choking hazard, or the bowl of water is a drowning hazard. There were batteries underneath the couch. There were cords that you didn't see from the adult view, that once you were on the child view, you could see that there were cords that were easily, you know, that the baby could pull on and then topple the lamp or the television on top of them. Chemicals that were at child level, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, a tub full of water that, you know, hadn't been drained yet. So lots of things that were particularly at the kid view that maybe when you were walking around as an adult, you didn't notice or didn't think of as a hazard.
And so how does this translate into giving advice to a patient or to the parents of a patient?
Mm-hmm. So particularly for family medicine and pediatrics as well, we do a lot of well child visits in our practices. And the biggest part of the well child visit, in addition to a thorough physical exam, updating vaccines, is really what's called the anticipatory guidance, where you counsel patients on what are the next developmental things happening with your kids and how do you help your kids remain safe. So we talk about a number of things with any of our young patients, including sunscreen and wearing helmets when they're getting ready to learn how to bike. And so having all of this information in your tool belt really lets you talk to patients and really help them get ready for their next steps of their kids' development.
How are students responding to this?
It's been really positive so far. I think it's a really engaging model, and it's, you know, there's only so long you can sit and listen to a lecture. And so this really gets people in the moment, lets them really be immersed in the experience. And the students have been responding really positively so far.
What do they say about it? I mean, is it a nice, neat home with batteries under the sofa, or are there piles of clothes laying around? And I'm trying to get a feel for what they're actually seeing.
Yeah. So in the geriatric simulation, it was a pretty disheveled house with a lot of hazards, and so the response was very strong. People were worried about that individual safety. In the second simulation, it was actually one of our attendings, our other faculty members, Dr. Osiello, who actually was the one who did the majority of the work on virtual reality, and he's in Hawaii right now, so we can be jealous of him while I talk to you. But it was his home, so I think it was important to show that it's not just...
Oh, it's a real house.
It was a real house where they videoed the simulation. And so you're walking around your attending's house and seeing there's household hazards no matter who you are and where you live.
And what do they do when they see the household hazards in the virtual reality lesson? Can they rectify it?
They can't rectify it in the simulation, but they kind of, if you think about it almost like a mouse, your eyes can hover over it,
mm-hmm.
And then the information pops up about why it's important, what you can do. And then after the virtual reality simulation, you debrief it as a group with the other attendings, and you talk through the different hazards, how you would talk to patients, what surprised you, how did it make you feel? So there's a whole debriefing process that you do afterwards to, again, really help solidify the knowledge that you've gained.
Have you thought about offering this to parents?
you know, we have all kinds of ideas of what we could do with this, and that is something that we have thought about. This would be great to do with parents in the office while you have them there, and to show them this is what a baby sees. I think it's really, you know, I always tell my parents to get down on the floor, hands and knees, crawl around, look at what you can find, but this would be a nice way to help parents start that conversation.
Lori Hamema, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Dr. Lori Hamema is the program director for the Family Medicine Residency at Ohio Health Methodist Riverside Hospital, Riverside Methodist Hospital. We've been talking about using virtual reality simulation in training residents there. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Competitive esports bring to mind post-apocalyptic scenarios, lots of guns and often a few zombies thrown in for good measure. In the U.S., at least, farming hasn't been a big draw. Farm Simulator 19 could buck that trend, especially in the esports arena. Joining us by phone is Executive Director of the National Association of Collegiate Esports, Michael Brooks. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also by phone, TechSpot reporter David Matthews. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
David, what is this game? What do players do in it?
So Farming Simulator 2019 is basically exactly what the name says. You spend the day actually farming, planting seeds, watering, literally doing everything that you would do in real life in order to actually grow crops, including using all of the machinery.
Well, it doesn't sound competitive.
Right. So it's funny that you should say that, because what some people will see as boring and mundane, other people see it as a chance to actually compete. Like, in for example, one of the primary ways people have been competing in farming simulators is simply by seeing how fast they can stack bales of hay. And That might seem kind of boring, but for them, that's like the greatest thing ever.
Well, I have actually stacked bales of hay in my life, and I enjoyed it a lot. But I'm trying to think about translating that to esports. Michael Brooks, what do you think?
I think it's interesting. It's when I first saw the announcement, I think I wasn't alone in being a little surprised that farming simulator would be something that organized competition would try to be built around.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I had the same thoughts in terms of, well, how do you do this? Is the gaming population? Is the audience there? What does this look like? And I'm still trying to understand that. But certainly, I think I'm one of the clear evangelist out there, and that, you know, esports is here, it's here to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always interested in seeing the audiences expanding into different categories, different audience types. So it's something I'm paying close attention to, and then trying to, of course, always understand is there a potential fit somewhere down the line in the college space.
David Matthews, is this something that is attracting different kinds of gamers than, say, Fortnite would?
Yes, actually, and that's actually the appeal of something like opening up Farming Simulator to esports, is because now you have a whole segment of the population who now can compete in something that they're passionate about. And you know, some people, when most people think of esports, you know, they think of the Fortnites or the Overwatches or the League of Legends or the Dotas. But mm-hmm. in this sense, now you have a whole segment of the population who, you know, they love to farm. They love to get away from their day job, which might be exciting, and go over and play a game where you literally farm and grow crops and all of that. So for them, this is a way to express themselves and to bond and compete with other people who share that same kind of love.
Giants Software is offering about $280,000. I don't know if it's a single prize or in prize money in its 10-tournament esports program. How does that compare to other esports tournaments?
Well, actually, so the Dota International, which is the king of all, basically, esports, I mean, they can get millions and millions of dollars, which I believe is split between the team that wins it. But, I mean, either way, if you have a team of, you know, four or five, and there's a $5 million prize, you know, each of you is taking home at least close to $1 million. So it's modest, but for a game where it doesn't seem, for a game where it's not as popular, at least not yet, as some of the larger esports titles, I think that's still a significant sum of money.
Michael Brooks, what makes a successful esports game when it comes to collegiate competition?
There's a lot that goes into defining when a game reaches that esport title. I mean, you're trying to look at a large player base. You're trying to understand, has there been a competitive structure in that game in the past? Are there organized teams? What is the viewership numbers behind an esport? I mean, every publisher out there, with maybe a few exceptions, would love to see their game become an esport, because then it moves your product, this game, from basically a commodity where you're trying to sell as many games as possible to mm-hmm. as many people as possible mm-hmm. to something that is an event oriented. It's an activity. It's something that extends the life, because you've organized competition and a fan base around it many years beyond the initial release and normal lifespan of a typical game. At the collegiate level, I mean, we absolutely look at what is the interest from potential students that want to play this game. Is there an audience of enough size to where we think we can build content around it and have that content be marketable and certainly valuable to all the different parties involved? And lastly, we're trying to understand the longevity of a game at the collegiate level, because we're offering scholarships, obviously. And those scholarships, we want them to last the life of a student through their college career. So we're looking at 4 to 5 years, which in esports is a little bit easier said than done to predict the lifespan of any game. Mm.
And the attraction to the viewing audience, right?
100%. Yeah. If we're going to build competition and content around any game, any esport, we want to make sure that the content being created is being appreciated and valued by audience. And in our minds, we hope that to be a large audience.
David Matthews, the farm simulator, it's gone through a lot of iterations to get it to this point, right?
Right. I mean, I believe the game first started in 2008. And so each successive generation has added more features, farming equipment to use. So in fact, if I'm not mistaken, with the 2019 version, I believe John Deere was added as one of the actual equipment that you can use. So not only does this actually increase the amount of exposure that the players have to actual construct or actual farming company, like tech companies, you know, it also just expands what you can do, and it makes it, I guess, less mundane, and it can actually attract other people who may be interested in the game, especially if they're already doing that in real life.
Farming.
And they can kind of compare, right. So if they're already in agriculture, they can kind of compare, does the game accurately represent what I do in real life? And because the game itself goes for realism.
Mm-hmm. And it's really popular in Europe, right?
Right. In fact, the tournament that's about to begin, the Farming simulated league is actually going to be in Europe. I think it's going to be around 10 tournaments around the continent. And so, yeah, it's pretty popular there.
Is that what you're looking at, Michael Brooks? I mean, how much do you look at that kind of stuff about how it's doing in other countries?
Well, we absolutely do, because we hope that's reflective of a potential audience here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our colleges and universities, they're trying to recruit students within a 4 to 6 hour driving radius of their primary campus. That's very similar to recruitment in traditional athletics. But that being said, international recruitment in esports, to put it lightly, it's in its very early stages. Mm-hmm. It's not really a thing yet. And when we do see international students, they typically come out of Asia. So typically China and South Korea, to be specific.
Mm-hmm.
So expanding into Europe and potentially extending audiences and potential, more importantly, recruits is deeply important. But, you know, and this may not be true in this situation, but we're trying to see cross audiences in a specific game here. And I think we're early in terms of a farming simulator, at least on that front.
Besides, you know, you mentioned stacking bales of hay, David Matthews. What else?
Honestly, that's actually one of the main things that you can do in the game. Although, because there are different vehicles in the game, like, you can actually drive a different irrigation vehicles the one that you use to actually stack the bales of hay. You can actually use those to race. So if you really wanted to, you could, you know, race a tractor around and see who could actually win in that kind of race. And in fact, that's actually a real thing in real life. Like,
yeah.
I've been to events where they have tractor races.
Right, I know.
I
hear you on that. I'm just trying to figure out the appeal of that in an increasingly non-agrarian society. I think it's an interesting juxtaposition of technologies. Michael Brooks, I mean, are there other comparable games out there that aren't all action figures and are more like this?
I mean, yes. So when we say esports, that's very similar to saying sports, right? We're talking about competitive gaming, and that crosses many different interests. I mean, we've got, as you said earlier, first-person shooters, battle royales, racing games, fighting games, MOBAs, and certainly sports simulation games. So, you know, from personal level and perhaps a professional one as well, definitely interested to see, could this be the opening of a new demographic,
mm-hmm.
a new audience niche that those other genres of games just aren't of an interest or not a primary interest?
But
that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting to me, too. But I'm wondering, is that's several steps away from collegiate esports, right?
Yeah, as of right now, yes. I mean, we've got at the collegiate level, because we are making investments over years in our students and ideally looking to, you know, grow the brand of a school, grow the audience,
mm-hmm.
And the value behind that. You know, we're always going to be within our niche of the esports market, much more selective on the games that are kind of welcomed into the fold. You know, we look at for example, I'll talk about another genre here, battle royale games. That's
mm-hmm.
Fortnite, that's PUBG, that's the new Call of Duty, for example, is extended mm-hmm. into that category as well. The problem we have there, even though that's a wildly popular genre, is every year we seem to have a new game that comes in that space that basically takes the crown, and that is the game to speak of. It was PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, and then Fortnite came out,
mm-hmm.
and the player base seemed to move over there in a pretty sizable way. So that's great in terms of the, you know, crazy the size of the audience there,
mm-hmm.
but for an administrator, that's a unique challenge there. And how do you build a team in a certain game and make sure that team's there to stay?
Because when you're recruiting teams, you recruit them for the particular games, not for the sport, the larger sport.
Absolutely. Each esport we talk about has its own team, and those students typically do not compete in another esport. They compete in just that one.
Right. And all right. So that's kind of limiting you. How does it work, David Matthews? How are they making that work? I mean, it could change very quickly.
Exactly. And as Michael Ashley alluded to, I mean, some of these games, you know, they pop in and they're popular for a while and they go away. And in fact, even before PUBG, there was a game called H1Z1, which is originally, I think it was like a zombie game, but then it kind of moved into some a battle royale type game. And so that was really popular for a while. And then PUBG took over, and now Fortnite took over. And so it's kind of hard to recruit for those kind of games if you don't really know, one, how well the developer is going to support the game and how popular the game is going to be. I mean, is Fortnite going to be around next year in 2020? Is it just a fad?
How do you work that out with developers, Michael Brooks? Do you get commitments from them?
Well, welcome to another difficulty of esports. I mean, we typically look for kind of a sizable show of good faith. We want publishers, if they're building or investing in competition, to show us a game plan for years out in the future. What is the competition going to look like? How are you expanding the scale and the size of that competition? Is there a prize pool? What is the expectation of that prize pool moving forward, not only year one, but year two, year three, year four, and so on and so forth? Publishers are businesses at the end of the day, and so those change, those plans can change quite dramatically based on the results of whatever their pilot is. And I would definitely consider Farming Simulator to be very much in its pilot year in terms of esports.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a unique challenge, and certainly it is beyond the norm right now for publishers to agree to anything more than 1 year out.
Wow.
There's very few agreements beyond that.
Well, yeah, that does pose a hazard for collegiate esports.
Oh, 100%. That is that's one of the challenges our member institutions have asked us at the national level to help organize, to provide assurances that when we form teams, when we make investments into a certain game, from the institutional perspective, that those investments won't go to waste, that we have some game plan for how this will work out for the near-term future at the very minimum.
And as far as the players themselves, David Matthews, I mean, they learn a game and they become expert at it and they compete at that. Don't they want to play other games? Don't they want to do other things?
Well, you can actually compare it to more mainstream sports like basketball or football. I mean, you have kids who play basketball at a very young age, and that becomes their passion. Mm-hmm. So they grow up getting better and getting better. Next thing you know, they're playing in the NBA. And so it's the similar thing with esports. I mean, once you find a game that you really like, someone older game called Counter-Strike Global Offensive, or CSGO. And so that's been around for a long time, but there are players who have stuck with that game since it first came out, and they've just gotten so much, they're so great at it that they don't really want to have to relearn how to play another mm-hmm. game or get good at another game.
Yeah, but then there's the audience issue, right?
Exactly. So then there's, are people still going to be watch? Are people still going to watch them play this game, even though it's 10 years out from the initial release?
Right. And Michael Brooks, you need the audience as well to support the sport at the collegiate level.
Yes, absolutely. So it's similar to traditional athletics in that our schools, because they are putting resources into these programs, they need a way to provide value back to the institution, mm-hmm. Specifically in this case, monetary value. So because esports occurs in the digital arena as opposed to an in-person competition, with a few exceptions, we don't have the traditional ways to monetize. We don't have concession sales. We don't have ticket sales. We don't have in-arena activation. So that results in us having to focus so much more on sponsorships and advertising, because most of the competition is viewed through streaming platforms, for example, like Twitch or YouTube or Mixer.
Mm-hmm.
So the audience becomes even more critical at the esports level than some traditional sports. Maybe not the big ones that we think of, like basketball or football, mm-hmm. but talking more about like softball or volleyball or even baseball now at the college level.
Do you think there's a football equivalent out there for collegiate sports when it comes to esports?
There are probably quite a few publishers who would like to say that
yeah.
the game is the equivalent of esports. I mean, that's kind of the crown there.
Yeah.
We mentioned a few of these. CSGO and League of Legends amongst college games, those are games that have been around for over a decade each. Dota 2 as well, but Dota 2 adoption levels at the collegiate level is not strong for a few different reasons. But those two, because they've been around for so long, there is a clear professional structure to it and long-term planning from the publishers there. Those and huge audience numbers as well, those are the two we typically think about when talking about collegiate esports.
And forgive me, David Matthews, if I've asked you this already, but what's it like to watch the Farm Simulator?
Well, I guess that kind of depends on your particular interest.
What you're into, okay.
Right. So, I mean, if you're a person who normally watches fast-paced first-person shooters like Overwatch or CSGO, then it might not necessarily be your cup of tea. However, mm-hmm. for a game like this, I think the appeal of this game is that it's so different and that it's so not like other kinds of esports that it almost creates a draw in and of itself. It's like, wow, you mean people actually, you know, race to see who can stack bales of hay using a forklift? People mm-hmm. really do that? Let me go see. Let me go watch that. Let me actually see if that's actually appealing. So that might actually be the appeal in and of itself.
And then I don't know if it was as you wrote or as someone else wrote, and then all of a sudden, next thing you know, an hour later, you're still watching.
Exactly. You might be interested in something that you never even knew you would be into. So,
well, I want to thank you, David Matthews, for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
David Matthews, TechSpot reporter, has written about Farm Simulator 19. It's out today. Michael Brooks, executive director of the National Association of Collegiate Esports. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Yep.
More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Kingdom Hearts 3 released today on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. The role-playing game originally debuted in 2002. It has remained popular for 16 years. It has a cult following due in part to the cameos from Disney characters and other gameplay worlds. Joining us to talk about what's new, Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So what makes Kingdom Hearts so popular?
It blurs together a couple of different ideas in the gaming world. This was kind of a new thing back in 2002, but it took a lot of the gaming elements that were really popular with Japanese audiences and introduced them to American audiences in kind of a new way by meshing them together with Disney characters. So this kind of fight system where you're running around and doing a whole bunch of different things was really new at the time, where you're not just hacking and slashing and you're not just using magic and you're not just summoning creatures. It was kind of all of this stuff together. And that was still not a super popular thing in 2002.
And your favorite Disney character.
Right. And it pulled together just all of the things from the Disney universe. And it grew as the game grew, from different worlds, you know, from Nightmare Before Christmas and you know, obviously Mickey and Goofy and Donald and Winnie the Pooh and just a ton of different other things. As the game continued to grow and as Disney's kind of culture empire continued to grow, we started seeing things like Pirates of the Caribbean show up in the games. Mm-hmm. Tron showed up in the game at one point. And as we move into Kingdom Hearts 3, there's just this massive Disney empire that the company can now pull from you know, things like Frozen and just this massive cult following. Although, weirdly, nothing from Star Wars or Marvel's The Avengers are in these games.
It is weird. What do you make of that?
I don't really know. I kind of figured, given what they did with Pirates of the Caribbean back in the day, that those would show up in here in some point, but they're nowhere to be found, and there's not any kind of commentary on why.
Hmm. So what new characters are we seeing?
Each world that you go to is very much a world from a Disney story. So you show up pretty early on in the game in the, you know, in Arendelle, the land of the Frozen movie. And you can play with a bunch of the characters from that game, and then you move on to just a ton of different worlds to see characters, not just from Disney series, but also from Square Enix's popular Final Fantasy series. So it kind of pulls all of those elements together in a really kind of unique way that doesn't really get done in other games.
How much does Disney get involved in how the characters are used? I mean, they have to be. They can't be used too much against character, right?
No, Disney has a lot of say in how these things get used. And in each world, the character that you pick has a very specific set of rules that it can follow. And a lot of the creatures that you're fighting are, it's kind of a violent combat system, but not a bloody combat system. So you're never seeing any of these Disney villains, you know, quote unquote, kill anybody. So there's a lot of kind of rules as far as that goes.
So Winnie the Pooh is just batting bees out of the air kind of a thing.
Right. Winnie the Pooh is very much it's its own kind of mini game puzzle thing where you're kind of saving the 100-acre wood by walking around with him and solving puzzles and stuff. He's not like fighting with you or anything. Stitch, on the other hand, you can summon and he pulls out two great big laser guns and helps you, you know, shoot all the bad guys because Stitch is like that.
So this can, how many worlds do you get in a game?
So in the previous games, there have been 10 and 12 worlds. That you could travel to, and I have not actually beaten this one yet, so I don't know how many there are total. But the idea is that, you know, each one of these worlds represents another step in kind of a larger story that's connecting all of these things together.
Cooking is part of the game? What's that? What's going on with that?
Yeah, so this is a weird new mini game that got added to the game, and it is, you know, creating your own potions and things to kind of help you out along the way, and you are cooking with the rat from Ratatouille, where he jumps up on your head and controls you and helps you make things.
Wow. How does it incorporate skills or tools from other iterations of the version? Are there connections?
Yeah, there's a lot of connections from a bunch of different games, because this Kingdom Hearts is a series that was not just on kind of the traditional PlayStation and Xbox consoles. This was also on handheld consoles as back far back as the Nintendo DS, and continued forward through those handheld games. And so a lot of those kind of quick action things that got added to those smaller games have been put in this game for things like, you know, running up walls and spinning around things to attack multiple enemies and things like that. So if you have played previous Kingdom Hearts games, really any of the previous Kingdom Hearts games, you're going to find a lot of familiarity with those games. If you have played all of those Kingdom Hearts games, then you're going to have a lot of information to kind of pull from. But also, if you have never played a Kingdom Hearts game, the game is still a lot of fun and pretty comfortable, but you are going to be a little confused by some of the stuff that's going on.
Okay. And so you're saying people should pick it up because it's going to be fun no matter what, although there may be some confusion.
It's going to be a lot of fun. There could be some confusion if you've never played any of the Kingdom Hearts games before, but you'll pick up pretty quickly. But if you have played any of the previous games, then you should definitely pick it up because it finishes a really good story.
Yeah. What do you think? Does it go back to the story again? Is what makes things special?
I think in this case, the story is what makes things special. It really kind of ties together a lot of things that, you know, someone in particular in my age who grew up with Disney characters and who really appreciated the Final Fantasy games as a teenager, you know, it kind of pulled all of those things together into something that was fun to follow and had its own kind of story. So for that, the story is definitely worth it. But it's also just a fun game to play.
You wanted to talk about Skullcandy headphones. We do talk about headphones from time to time. They're wireless over-the-ear headphones. They're pretty expensive, but they have a pair that's affordable. What's different?
Skullcandy headphones can range pretty wildly in price when it comes to, you know, whatever kind you're looking for. And wireless headphones typically are a little more expensive than most. But Skullcandy wanted to make a decent set of wireless headphones that you could get for $50, and they call them the Rift Bluetooth wireless headphones. Like all other forms of Skullcandy headphones, there is a giant funny-looking skull on either side for you to look at. And they're really just kind of they're kind of decent on-ear headphones that are actually sound pretty good as long as you're not looking for sound cancellation or noise cancellation.
Okay.
They're really just kind of they're surprisingly good for how much you would pay for them. But they are also $50 headphones. They're a little on the flimsy feeling side. The band that connects the two headphones as you put them around your head flexes a lot and feels like it could break pretty easily. But the sound quality is really good. And for $50, I can't think of another set of headphones that I would compare these to that would be as good.
But the noise cancellation thing, that means that it's not good in a loud place. It's...
Right. If you're on an airplane or if you're, you know, in a louder place and you're trying to use these headphones, you're gonna hear what's going on in the outside world because there's no active or passive noise cancellation. These headphones, they sit on your ear. They do not cover your ears. So there's a lot of noise interference there, which is common for this price point. Noise sound isolation headphones can be pretty expensive for ones that actually work really well.
And there's no wired option, right?
There's not a wired option for these. These are designed to be wireless options, but Skullcandy makes a version of these headphones with a wire if you would prefer that.
Mm-hmm. Well, who does? ZenPods. It's an AirPods case. It has an added feature. This is pretty crazy. Tell us about it.
This is the weirdest thing, and it was one of those things that when we saw it, like, my entire team just kind of laughed, and then they got really excited as they went to play with it because it is weirdly satisfying. This is a case that wraps around your AirPods, your wireless headphones for your iPhone, and they have a little notch on either side of the case that you wouldn't normally see in an AirPods case, and it moves. In fact, it turns the AirPods case into a fidget spinner. when the headphones are closed, you can kind of flick them around in your finger and move them around. Otherwise, these are very much the exact same, you know, AirPods case that you would get from Apple when you buy AirPods.
Mm-hmm.
But these they're colored a little differently, which helps it kind of stand out a little bit. And the spinning thing really kind of makes it harder to lose because you're constantly playing with it, so you're less likely to set it down somewhere or leave it in your pocket and put it through the laundry like somebody has done more than once.
Somebody you know has done. No names mentioned. It's kind of an interesting – I'm wondering how they came up with it. You know, what were they thinking?
Yeah, so I know that this kind of thing starts with people looking for AirPods cases that stand out a little bit, because if you have more than one person that you know in your immediate, you know, environment that has a set of AirPods, it's really easy to confuse them because they all look exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to distinguish them. So we've started to see a couple of companies that make these kind of cases that will let the AirPods attach to your key rings or just make it easier to find by being a different color. And so I think this is just ZenPod, you know, kind of standing out just a little tiny bit further from the other companies making cases by adding a metal disc and a ball bearing so that you can spin it around in your finger.
Does it spin around as easily as a fidget spinner?
It does. It feels very much like a fidget spinner when you go to flick it around in your hand.
$30. Does that pretty much the going rate for these things?
These are a little more expensive than your average AirPod case or wrap. You usually will find them for about half of that price, depending on where you're looking. But you're obviously getting something a little bit extra for that. So,
is it obviously a fidget spinner?
It is not. It really just looks like an AirPods case that has a little metal disc on either side. It's really not until you pick it up and actually spin it that, you know, kind of everyone in the area goes, oh, wow, look at that.
Do they advertise it?
They do. Yeah, it's pretty clear when you go to buy it that that's what you're buying.
Any negatives?
Really just the biggest thing is that it's not super great for if you are switching back and forth between devices on a regular basis, like mm-hmm. if you This is a really kind of niche thing, but if you switch back and forth between phones and you kind of have to hit the pairing button on the AirPods case to repair it to another phone, and that button isn't easily accessible from the AirPods, the ZenPod case, you kind of have to take your AirPods case out of the ZenPods case to hit that pairing button.
Is that because of the spinner thing?
Yeah, it's because the spinner thing is kind of in the way there. But also, it's just not a button that, like, once you've paired your AirPods to your phone the one time, most people don't need to use that button again. So hiding it isn't a huge deal.
Yeah, you are in a special niche.
I am.
Russell Holly.
I have a problem.
You are. You're a special niche. You wanted to talk about a camera. It's called the Intel RealSense. What's it different? What's different about this?
So Intel has been working on a set of cameras called the RealSense cameras for a while now, and these are depth sensing cameras, which means it's actually multiple sensors, not just a single lens. And it's when it takes a picture, it is aware of how far away things are from it. So if I am standing 10 feet from the camera when it takes a picture, it uses depth sensing technology to measure the space between it and me and know that that is 10 feet. And that kind of spatial understanding is important for a lot of different technologies. Augmented reality systems use it to tell the difference between, you know, objects in a room to see how far away things are and to use that to place things. Drones are starting to use these cameras so that they can be better at flying through indoor environments and not collide into walls and things like that. Being able to tell, you know, depth in kind of a real-time way has become really important for a lot of these kind of complex computers. And Intel has been one of the companies that started making these cameras a couple of years ago. And this new version has come out to kind of make it easier for just a ton of different companies to start working on kind of the next generation of that depth sensing technology.
Right. It's the depth sensing technologies being used in other things. They're adapting it to a camera now.
Right. This is something, you know, the idea is being able to use it for a more realistic view of the world. You know, instead of just kind of that flat picture, it's useful for a lot of different things, including kind of systems that use facial recognition software to determine, you know, whether or not it's okay to allow you into a building, for example.
Uh-huh.
Being able to, you know, it makes it so that you can't just hold up a picture of someone's face, for example. To gain access through that, you'd actually have to have a three-dimensional contour in the same way that you would, you know, through any kind of depth sensing environment.
There's no need for external sensors with this camera. What is an external sensor and why doesn't it use one?
So a big part of what we've seen with other facial recognition systems, in particular the one that is in the iPhone, for Face ID is a separate what's called dot projector, where it takes infrared light and it projects it all over your face to create that map and uses that information to authenticate, you know, against the picture of your face. Those two things line up, then it lets you into your phone. Instead of having an entirely separate sensor to do that, it's all kind of built into one thing. And that ends up being really useful for developers because it all is built into one tool.
How much is this going to cost and who's going to use it?
This is going to start. It's available for pre-order now for $200. And Intel's goal is to have this used in as many different places as possible. Intel hopes that drone manufacturers will pick it up and incorporate it into the next generation of consumer-facing drones. Companies will pick it up and start using it for you know, depth sensing technology for augmented reality and virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
This probably isn't something that most people would buy and set up in their home unless they wanted to kind of play around with this idea. But this camera will most likely be added to other things that we will use in the future.
Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us as usual. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, Android Central contributing editor. Thanks for listening. This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.